tomatoes, pickles, onions. I think that's everything that happened. Everything I did and didn't do. Everything I did to keep my people safe. To survive in this new world without Coop. Except for the cell phone and the contents of the safe, the wad of money Coop had held to my face, and one tiny slip of paper. I couldn't be sure at the time, but a second cell phone and contents of a safe seemed like safe bets for things to remove from a crime scene. Chapter 40. Now. I don't hesitate for 1 second when I shoot Ward in his chest. That was the plan, if it came to it, if I was forced into a corner. And there I was, in that corner. I don't think I knew I could do it until he shot my mom in our living room. But as we walked the stairs to my bedroom, I did know. It was me or Ward. Only one of us was coming out of there alive. And I still didn't know why or what any of this was about. What Ward Harlow wanted with Coop, or the stuff he'd hidden somewhere, or even if he'd killed Coop in that prep room of the Triple S that night, because for the life of me, I thought it was one of my friends. He looks at me as he grabs his chest with both hands, his gun falling to the ground. He looks at me with surprise, because even though I have been ruthless, finally figuring out who he is, knowing that he would never leave me alone, even if I gave him the phone and the paper from the safe, and now just shooting him in the chest without a care, I am still just a teenage girl with a ponytail standing there in front of him as he falls to the ground onto my shaggy beige carpet and dies. I'm shaking violently, holding the gun with both hands, pointing it at Ward even as he lies dead on the ground. It has not hit me yet that I have done this. It has not hit me yet that this is over. And I haven't really slept for days. I hear pounding on the front door, and then silence, and then the door breaking and feet racing up the stairs. I hear Ian's voice before I see him, calling in on his radio about a shooting at our address, backup requested, an ambulance. He stands in my doorway and looks at me just as Ward had looked at me. But whatever he's feeling, it doesn't stop him. "Charlie," he says softly, "give me the gun." I am in a trance. They have come to rescue me, and it's safe to come out now, out of the forest where I've been a savage. I feel the fear subside. I feel a slow drip of safety enter my blood. But then I remember my mom. My mom! "She's okay. She's awake," she pointed to the stairs. Relief overwhelms me as I give Ian the gun. Then he takes my hands and rubs them on his hands to transfer some of the residue. "Go wash them now, with soap and warm water. Dry them well, then change your clothes. Throw those in the bottom of the hamper. Do it now, Charlie." We both hear the sirens coming from town. When I do as he's instructed and return to the bedroom, Ian is moving things around. He puts Ward's gun back in his right hand and then asks me for confirmation. "He's right-handed?" I look at him, confused, but manage to nod, remembering that Ward held the gun in his right hand. "I shot this man. I did it," Ian now says. "I came here and saw your mother shot. There was a gun on the floor beside her, the gun she tried to use to protect both of you. I picked it up, then came upstairs and saw this man holding his gun on you, and I told him to stop and put the gun down, but instead he lunged toward me and I fired. I shot him with the gun that was in my hand from downstairs." "But," I begin to say, thinking that a good cop would have left that first gun on the floor and drawn his own weapon as he climbed the stairs.
"I know," Ian says. "But I'm a rookie.
This is my first shooting. I was conflicted in that moment, and he could see it on my face.
Charlie, I'll be fine, I promise.
But you, it's not the same. We hear the paramedics. They're with my mom, and I'm suddenly desperate to get to her. Yes, that was the conflict. Me shooting Ward in the chest with a gun I'd hidden in my closet, even if it was in self-defense, could spin out of control 100 different ways. I'd already refused to tell the police what I knew about the night of Coop's death. I'd already proven to be a strange girl with my running and my obsession with numbers and making sandwiches and getting out of Sawyer. I could not be the girl who saved her tribe, who figured things out and made things right. Girls who shoot men in the chest without a second thought are not brave. They are not heroes. They are either victims or villains. Or, in my case, unwanted snowflakes. Two officers enter the room. I tell them I need to see my mom and run past them, down the stairs to the stretcher and the people gathered around her. She's going to be all right, one of the paramedics tells me. And I don't know if I believe her, because people say all kinds of things to frantic teenage girls. But I let myself believe as I get in the back of the ambulance with them and drive away. Chapter 41. Now. I give my statement at the hospital while my mom is in surgery. They like it. I can tell. Every word. What I say matches Ian's account of the events to a T, because that was our plan. And when I think about what he did and what he risked for me, I know that I will have a lot to sort out when I finish doing what needs to be done today. This is what we both say. I didn't see anything the night Coop was murdered, but I began receiving threats soon after. One of the bad men must have seen me there and thought I'd seen him kill Coop or heard them fighting. After all, it took them a long time to clean up the store and move his body. I was then fooled by Ward Harlow pretending to be FBI agent Zellman right up until he came to the house to kill me and my mom walked in, so he tried to kill us both. They checked Dusty's gun and found lots of prints. Mine, my mom's, Dusty's, DJ's, Everett's, and Ian's. There was no way to disprove the story. Ian came because I had called him earlier saying I was scared. This was mostly true. We never mentioned the pool of blood I'd found. As it turns out, there was no dead lawyer anyway. I had a hard time believing this when Ian told me. Daryl Romanski was not Dana Blakely. Daryl Romanski was, in actual fact, a young male associate from the law firm in Delaware that set up Coop's LLC. That's it. He was never involved in any of this. But I had brought up the possibility, and Agent Zellman, aka Ward Harlow, had jumped on the chance to confuse me. There was no real Dana Blakely either, just Ward's girlfriend, Angie, who agreed to help him work a different angle to get the cell phone and paper from the safe. She wasn't even a lawyer. She'd fooled everyone with her suit and pumps and tight bun of hair and fake website. That's all it takes around here. One of them was gaining my trust. The other was scaring the shit out of me. Good cop, bad cop. Fake Dana knew how to talk to me about getting out of here and going to college and all of that. She was very good at fooling us, me and my mom, because, rule number 21, people believe what they want to believe. And we both wanted to believe that someone was protecting us. But that wasn't all. They had a third conspirator. The only person who knew how to decode the number Coop left behind when he died. Regina Cooper. She was working me from inside my tribe, through Nora and the police, trying to scare me a different way into handing over the phone and the slip of paper from the safe, which would have gone right to Regina, who would then know what to do with it. The police couldn't figure out exactly what crimes Ward and Coop had committed together that would make Ward so desperate to get to the things Coop had hidden. Everyone assumed it was money, and that was that. In fact, Ward had told Regina it was money, money that Coop owed him, and threatened her and her daughter, Lillian. You'd never know it by how cool Regina acted when she came into the store with that box of documents, hoping we would recognize something that could help her. She worked that angle through me and Nora, and then she told Ward everything she knew about me so he could get his hands on that cell phone and the paper from the safe. She also told Ward everything she knew about Coop and his law firm, about his lawyer, Daryl Romanski. I had the number. Regina had the instructions to decode that number to reveal the location of whatever it was Coop had hidden away. Regina must have been pretty scared. Or maybe part of her was happy. Maybe part of her also wanted whatever it was her shitty, shithead, shit-for-brains husband had hidden. I couldn't have seen Regina coming. She seemed too shallow in every way to be that clever. Rule number 33. People can be smart and stupid all at once. As for the real FBI agent Max Selman, just like Daryl Romanski, they had borrowed his identity. He was a middle-aged desk agent who had no idea his name had been used to con a teenage girl. The rest of the story Ian and I give to the police went like this. I bought myself time by claiming I had Coop's cell phone hidden in my room, so Ward followed me there. The cell phone I handed him was nothing, just a throwaway, something I'd bought to text my friends without my mom knowing. But Ward kept asking me about it, so I figured producing some kind of phone would help me stall until the police got there. Ian busted in, found my mom, and saw Dusty's gun lying on the ground beside her, so he picked it up and came up the stairs. Dusty's gun in his hand, he shot Ward before Ward could shoot him. They asked him why he hadn't drawn his own gun as he climbed the stairs, and the truth is, he did draw his own gun, but he couldn't say that. Ward was shot with Dusty's gun, so Ian said he made a rookie mistake, just like he said he would. And that was that. Of course, that's just the story we tell the police, a story my mother would later corroborate by claiming to have a fuzzy memory because of having just been shot. When we leave the station that day, I still have no idea who had killed Coop, what Coop had hidden, or why. Chapter 42. Now. I wait with my mom through the night. She has surgery and wakes up, then goes back to sleep. I sleep too, in the chair by her bed, until Dusty arrives. He had to drive back from the kids' cabin, then drop the boys at his mother's house. He gives me a very quick hug, the kind you barely feel, then waits on her other side, in another chair. The next morning, she has a lot of tests, and I really need to go to work for the lunch rush. No one questions why I need my routine. And today, even Dusty doesn't care. He offers to call me an Uber since I don't have my bike, so I take one and go to the Triple S. There's a lot of excitement when I walk in the back door. There's a lot of explaining as well. Janice, Keller, Nora, and Helen are there. Tracy has the day off. No one can believe I have almost been killed by a criminal who also killed Coop over some business deal gone wrong. And then we start to prep for lunch. I always rotate the stock of metal pans in the refrigeration units. It's my job, and people leave it to me because it's not anything exciting or fun, and so who really cares? I put my jacket on because it's cold in there. I take out what we need for the day, pulling from the front, and then I put the newly stocked pans in the back. First in, first out. That's how food stays fresh. Everyone knows that. I do this for all the stock except the lettuce. There are 4 rows of lettuce pans, and they run 4 deep. Normally, I would pull the whole front row, move the ones behind them forward, then put the new pans we just shredded at the very back. Except today, I reached first for the four pans at the back, which have not been rotated since Friday night. Not since I wrapped the money from Coop's safe in plastic and aluminum foil, and then tucked it into the pans, and then covered it with shredded lettuce. I take out the money from three of the pans, and Coop's cell phone from the fourth, which I put there after that incident at the library. And I place everything into a small drawstring bag, which I then tuck into my jacket. I finish my work, return my coat and bag to the hooks in the back of the prep room, and join the team on the floor. It is strangely joyful to make sandwiches. We have a long rush, and the team lets me take the lead, asking for orders 10 at a time, laying out bread and meats and cheese and lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. I slip back into my normal routine, even though I'm exhausted, and even though I'm still waiting to hear about my mom. No one was worried when I left. I could tell that she was going to be okay. We all would be okay, as it turned out. The money in the safe amounted to $67,000. I had no problem keeping it and using it the way I did. The money was earned from sandwiches we made, but most of it should have gone to the government, so as far as I was concerned, it was like a ball that slipped from the player's hands and is floating through the air. What do they call that? A fumble? Dumbass Doug probably knows. Later that week, I would give that money to Keller. She refused at first, insisting I take the money to pay for college, but that didn't feel right to me. I was leaving. I was going to college. Keller needed it just to survive. The money would pay for 1 year of housing for Dot at a private nursing home in town, where they would at least give her the right medication and keep her safe. Keller would then be able to move in with Levi and live there for free, saving all of her money to pay for the next year at the home, and then the next and the next, year by year. That's how she could take things. She just needed that little head start to get Dot taken care of. $67,000 was a great head start. When I think about how little that is compared to other things, how little it really takes to save a life, and yet how hard it is to make $67,000 in a town like Sawyer, it leaves me perplexed. I don't know how else to describe it. The other thing I would do is pay a visit to the bus terminal on Maybury Street. It was on the ride home after seeing fake Dana's fake blood, then pedaling and pedaling until my brain cooled off and I was able to think, and then when I rode past street after street, that I knew what the middle set of numbers represented. 6292879, a street name with seven letters. I downloaded a program from the internet that took numbers and generated the possible words they could be based on a standard phone keypad. The seven digits in Coop's number were 6292879. It took a few hours, but I matched all of those words with a list of street names in Sawyer. And there it was, Maybury. We have a Maybury Street. Now, Maybury Street is one of our main streets in town, and it also has one of the only public places with lockers that is not in any way owned or funded by any kind of government, federal, state, or local. A Greyhound bus station. 345, the number of the locker. 6292879, digits that contain the letters for Maybury. And finally, the first piece I had figured out. 21704, the combination for the lock. The lock was an old-fashioned padlock, the kind that only comes off one of two ways, with the right combination or a giant bolt cutter, but that's something people would notice. The padlock was the circular kind, and it only had digits that went up to 20, so the combination could only be one set of numbers, 2 right, 17 left, 4 right. Why Coop had thrown in the extra zero before the 4 and not the 2 is anyone's guess, and I was too tired to do any more thinking. Especially thinking that included guessing. I hate guessing. I went during the busiest time of the day, Friday at 6 p.m., a week after Coop's murder. That's when people are all going somewhere for the weekend. We don't have a train station, so unless you have your own car, the bus is the only option. I wore a hoodie, baggy jeans, and sneakers. I bought everything at the mall, all different stores, and even bought them in the men's department just to be safe. Then I covered my fingers with small band-aids to keep my prints from being places they shouldn't be. I carried a duffel bag filled with crumpled up paper bags. Now that I know to look out for cameras, I spotted them right away and made sure to avoid them by walking in front of or behind people, always looking down, keeping my head covered by the hoodie. All those little details that you have to think about when you're committing a crime. But most of all, I made sure Regina wasn't having me followed. I did that by asking Nora to invite her to the store to meet with both of us at the exact time I planned to be at the bus station. She told Regina we'd found something in her box of documents that might help her locate the thing she was looking for. I will admit that my heart was jumpy when I found locker number 345, and jumpier still when I turned the first number on the lock, and then the second, and then the third, and then when I hear the click as I pulled straight down. I thought about what I would do if this was really my locker, and if I was just here swapping out one bag for another like I did this all the time. I would just stare straight ahead into my locker, knowing what was there, so it wouldn't cause me any hesitation or surprise. I pulled the latch. I opened the door. I saw the bag. I took the bag out and put the other one in, and I didn't look inside. I put the lock back in place, turned the dial, and pulled it once to make sure. And then I walk out of the station between two very tall men, my head down, my gait casual, and I didn't stop until I was four blocks away, where I'd left my bike. It was not easy to ride my bike with that bag. 852,764 dollars in assorted bills weighs a lot. When Regina got to the Triple S, Nora told her I had to go help with Keller's grandmother, and she didn't doubt it for a second. And then Nora gave her the paper from the safe with the number she'd gone to all that trouble to find. It probably took her most of the night to figure out what street 6292879 was, because Regina was not very good with numbers. So even though Coop had told her how to break the code, lock number, street, combination, that middle part is not easy. Each number corresponds to three or four possible letters, the ones on a dialing keypad, so it's a puzzle that requires some problem solving. I wonder what she thought when she went to all that trouble and then found only crumpled up paper bags inside that duffel bag. I wonder how long she cried and whether she was kicking herself for choosing the kind of man who cheats and steals and has a bald spot that gets shiny around girls half his age. I didn't keep that money. It wasn't mine, and besides that, I had already taken the $67,000 from the safe. Instead, I made a deal with Regina, who was facing a lot of trouble with the IRS after Nora gave them the spreadsheets that showed Coop had been cheating on his taxes. It served her right for lying about the IRS coming to her house and threatening her when really it was Ward Harlow. It served her right for scaring Nora half to death about it when the IRS had no idea what Coop had been doing all this time. With the money from the locker, Regina then made a deal with them that allowed her to keep some of it and not go to jail. But I wouldn't just hand it over. In exchange, Nora, Janice, and Keller now own 10% of the Triple S, which was restructured into a co-op, which means that the employees get to share in the profits as well as get their salaries. Regina probably won't make any money from it ever again, but I thought that was fair. I couldn't go back in time and tell my mom not to let Mr. Nelson get to her, and I couldn't not be born or make my grandparents not call her a whore and give her a better life in a better place, but I could do this one thing to help my other family.
And so I did it. But there was something else in that duffel bag I found in the locker. A small cassette tape in a plastic case with one word written on it. A name. Rudy. Chapter 43. It is now 10 days after I shot and killed a man, and finally, I have all of the pieces to the puzzle. First, who didn't kill Clay Cooper? Me. Keller, who was with her grandmother and waiting for Levi to come back. Levi, who gave up soon after he went looking for Coop and went to a bar and drank 6 beers. Nora, who stayed late at a potluck dinner to help clean up and was actually still there at the time of Coop's death. And Janice, whose neighbor saw her take out the trash around the same time. The tape I found in the duffel bag with the cash is a DVR. I had to buy an old camcorder on eBay to see what was on it. I watched it alone the first time, but the second time, I rode my bike to Ian's house and made him watch it with me. Once I saw it, I knew Ian was the second piece of the puzzle. It was surreal seeing Clay Cooper, Ward Harlow, Rudy Benton, and Cullen McGuire 18 years ago when they were seniors in high school. They looked so young, younger than we look now, but then people never see themselves how they really are. "What is this?" Ian asked me. I hadn't told him why I was coming or what I'd found, and of course, I hadn't forgotten what he'd said to me the night Coop was murdered, how he'd found the orange Buick in an old garage on one of Coop's properties. "Just watch," I told him. Clay Cooper, age 17, speaks as the recording plays. "Well, here we are, walking through the woods. Ooh, exciting. Is everyone excited? Rudy, hey, Rudy, don't trip, moron." Then he turns the camera on himself. His stupid fat face takes up the entire screen. "In case anyone gives a shit, our teacher bailed to go swimming, douchebag." Then it goes back to the three boys walking in front of him. "That's my dad," Ian said. "Yeah, your father, Rudy Benton, and..." "Holy shit, isn't that the guy you shot? Ward Harlow?" I nodded as we continued watching. The boys walk and talk trash. Ward is high-strung and agitated, like he can't contain something inside him. Something powerful and ugly. He snaps twigs from trees, kicks dirt. I notice his hands swinging, patting his legs like he doesn't know what to do with them. Until he does know. He takes one at first, his right hand, and shoves Rudy, who is directly in front of him. Rudy stumbles and falls to his knees, then gets up. He doesn't turn to defend himself. He says nothing, accepting what's happening as if it's happened before, as if he knows he will make it worse by speaking up. But Cullen McGuire, who is behind Coop and off camera, does. We hear his voice. "Cut it out, Ward." That's all he says. Ward turns around, looking past Coop to Ian's father, and tells him to shut the hell up. The boys keep walking. Coop keeps filming random things now, like the treetops and the steep ledge that's off to their right. The camera is not on the boys when we hear another thud and a cry this time. Then it jerks back to Rudy on the ground again, this time not getting up. He's hurt his leg and sits cradling it, trying not to make a scene. Coop says, "Damn!" Ward laughs. Cullen moves now, in front of Coop and Ward to help Rudy. He tries to help him up. "Can you stand?" Cullen asks him. Rudy leans on Cullen and tries to put weight on his leg, but it buckles. Cullen looks at Ward with disgust, but doesn't escalate the situation. "Let's get him down." Coop keeps filming, zooming in on what looks like a bloody kneecap. "Damn," he says again. "You're such a weenie, you know that?" Ward says to Rudy. Cullen tries to help Rudy walk in the other direction, past Ward. We have to get him back down. Coop, turn that damn thing off and help me. But Coop keeps filming. It's as if he knows this is not over. Are you okay? I asked Ian as we watched. I knew what was coming. He couldn't look away. Just keep playing it. As Cullen tries to walk past Ward, his hurt friend leaning against him, Ward grabs Rudy's arm and throws him to the ground. The other boys appear stunned as Coop stops commenting on each scene and Cullen stops protesting. What happens next is beyond disturbing. The first blow is a kick, Ward's hiking boot into Rudy's stomach. The next one is to his head, the next to his chest. They happen so fast it feels choreographed. An explosion of rage and violence that lasts maybe 3 seconds, but leaves Rudy unconscious. The last blow is Ward's spiked heel on Rudy's skull, so hard it cracks open, just like Coop's did the night he was killed. Ian gasped, and I paused the recording. "Play it back," he said. I hesitated long enough for him to say it again. "Play it back." I went back to the part where Ward grabs Rudy's arm, and this time Ian watched his father, who stands frozen, as if the suddenness of the attack has paralyzed him. "That's normal," I told him. "It's just fight or flight instincts. Your father froze because his brain was trying to catch up to what was happening." Ian didn't respond. I let it play on. Ward steps back and watches the blood. Coop says, "Holy shit! Holy shit!" But he doesn't stop filming. Giving him the benefit of the doubt, he was probably frozen as well, with the camera in his hand pointed at the scene. Regardless, he got it all on the tape. Ward looks at the unconscious and bleeding boy and lets out another laugh. "Whoa," he says, as if impressed by his own strength. Then he looks around, sorting out the mess he's made. It doesn't take him long to decide. He grabs Rudy by both feet and drags him to the edge of the trail where it meets a steep cliff. Coop and Cullen don't move, except that Coop's camera follows Ward's movements and captures him rolling Rudy off the ledge. The camera then points to the ground, but the sound of the body falling is unmistakable. The picture moves again to what appears to be inside the front pouch of Coop's sweatshirt, where there is no clear image, only sound. Then there are voices. Ward says, "He fell. That's it. He got too close and slipped and fell." Cullen and Coop are silent. There is shuffling, like leaves and dirt being moved. "Help me cover the blood, you morons. We're all on the hook for this. Better make it look like an accident." It's unclear if they helped, but no one says another word, except for this exchange as they appear to be rushing back down the mountain. Ward says, "Hey, you didn't film that, did you?" And Coop says, "No, man, no. Do I look like an idiot?"
"Oh my God,"
Ian said when it was over.
"Ward killed him. It wasn't an accident. He killed him."
"I know. Ward killed Rudy Benton, and then they all kept it quiet and pretended it was an accident. And Coop had it on tape. That's what Ward was really after. When Coop died, Ward was afraid someone would find it and everyone would see him killing Rudy Benton, intentionally killing him."
"And there's no statute of limitations on murder."
We both sat there as I let Ian come to the same conclusion I had come to.
"You know,"
he said then, and I nodded. This is when I got the second piece to the puzzle. Who did kill Coop and why? Coop was blackmailing Ward all these years, and Ward couldn't kill Coop until he had that tape and every copy there might be, And even then, he could never be sure. Coop probably told him there were dozens of copies, and maybe there are. Maybe this is just the original. Ward couldn't kill Coop. But when he was killed, Ward knew he had to track down the tape any way he could. Ian repeated what he'd said a moment before. You know, I had my suspicions. Ian called me that night. I didn't know it at the time, but he was on his way to the Triple S to confront Coop about the orange Buick. I didn't hear who was fighting with Coop in the back room or who had swung that tomato slicer at his head. But it wasn't Ward Harlow. It was then Ian told me the part I didn't hear when I was in the bathroom gathering the courage to walk past Coop and his shiny bald spot and that wad of dirty money. What happened after Ian pulled into the parking lot and walked right in through the back door, which was unlocked. He told me, Charlie, Ian said, when I confronted him about the car. He told me he'd been blackmailing Ward for 7 years after Ward got rich with some metalworks company in Pittsburgh. He said he offered some of it to my dad, but he refused. And then, when my dad couldn't take it anymore, when he was drinking himself to death and my mom was ready to leave him, he told Coop he wanted to go to the police. Coop told me he begged my father to reconsider, but he wouldn't. He said that he decided to just lie and tell him he would give him the tape. He said they had to meet on that old stretch of Highway 65 where no one would see them because Ward was always following him, trying to find out where that tape was hidden. So my dad went there. He must have gotten out of the car and stood behind it when he saw the headlights approach. Ian stopped for a moment, and I thought he might cry, but he didn't. He choked it back and kept telling the story of the night his father died. And then when Coop got close, he didn't slow down. He kept on driving until he ran right into him, killing him like a scared animal. That's what Coop called him, Charlie. He called my father a scared animal, frozen with cowardice. He mocked him. Mocked his weakness, and he told me I was just like him. And then he offered me my father's cut of the money he was getting from Ward Harlow. Ian, I tried to comfort him, but he didn't want it. He wanted to tell this next part. That was when I threw the first punch, and it just got out of control. Coop had his hands around my throat, and I was able to push him off me, and he fell to the ground. But then he started to get up, and he grabbed a knife from the shelf beneath the table. And I knew he was going to kill me, Charlie, because I knew what he'd done, and he knew I would tell the department, and they would find the car. I saw the slicer and picked it up, and when he came at me again, I swung it, Charlie. I swung it right at his head. I sat beside him, and this time I was the one to settle his hot head and stop him from shaking. When he calmed down, he told me that he ran away from the scene, that he went to his mother's house and told her everything so that she wouldn't be shocked when he was arrested. He wanted to say goodbye to her, but she held on to him like she was drowning and he was the last life preserver in the entire ocean. She held on and begged him not to tell anyone what he'd done. She told me no one would believe me about being scared for my life, that Coop owned this town, and who was to say that I didn't just go there and kill Coop with intention? I couldn't prove it was self-defense. I couldn't prove he threatened me with a knife. The town would make sure I got the maximum, she said, to pay for his death. Ian told me he promised her he wouldn't confess unless an innocent person was ever accused. He would stay silent and live with his guilt the way his father had lived with his guilt, so that she wouldn't have to watch him spend his life in jail.
I had no idea you were in trouble, Charlie. You never told me. You just said the FBI was investigating Coop, and I thought maybe that would help everyone. Maybe it would make it so no one was ever accused of his murder, that they would assume it was this criminal he was involved with. I thought maybe I would be able to keep my promise to my mom and also keep an innocent man from going to jail.
The final piece to the puzzle was confirmation by Ward Harlow's co-conspirator, his girlfriend Angie, aka Dana Blakely, aka my lawyer, aka a very good liar who made me forget rule number 26, which is, if someone seems too good to be true, they are. She had been questioned and charged with some small things in exchange for her cooperation. She confirmed that Clay Cooper had been blackmailing Ward, but she didn't know what for. Ward told her Coop had just been murdered, which meant the evidence could be found and that it would be very, very bad for him, which would be very, very bad for her. Ward paid a visit to Regina Cooper the very next day. He threatened her just like she said, and Regina told him what she knew, that there was a number on his cell phone and in the safe that she alone could decode. She thought the number would lead to money. She also knew that I had been at the store because she checked the security camera footage. She was the one who gave it to the police as well. Together, Regina and Ward devised a plan for Angie to pose as a lawyer waiting for a client in the police station and for Regina to give us a nudge to find her. And it all worked out perfectly. They played me from three angles, trying to get their hands on the things they knew I must have taken, the cell phone and the paper from the safe. Or if I didn't, I probably knew who did, because of what I heard and maybe even saw. And that's it. All the pieces. Chapter 44. I take the last order. Chicken salad in a pita with shredded lettuce and tomato. That happens to be my favorite sandwich, and so I tell the woman who ordered it that it was a good choice, and she smiles and says thanks. It's right after that order that Dusty calls to tell me my mom is being discharged from the hospital, and he would like it very much if I could come home early. He sounds like he might even be crying. And this surprises me. It's a good surprise, because maybe it means that he really does love her beyond giving him the boys and cooking his dinner and sleeping in his bed. Or maybe that's what love is, what it gets boiled down to, just like my mom said, after the Keller and Levi love is gone. Maybe that's why she stays, even though I know she never loved him the way she loved Mr. Nelson, and that I am the reason she married him and had his babies and lets him sit at the pretend head of the table when she could have had her dreams. And that now she has decided it's too late for those dreams, that she is stuck in this snow globe. I don't know what to do with these thoughts, so I decide not to think about them at all. There will be time to think about all of that later, after I go home and hug my mom and tell her that I love her and that I know she loves me because she saved my life. Chapter 45. 2 years later. My mom picks me up at the bus station, which is ironic. I can't help but glance at locker number 345. It's not the first time I've been home from college, but usually I catch a ride with a friend who lives somewhere along the way, or my mom comes all the way to get me. She likes coming to Boston. She likes driving her car with the MIT sticker on the back and parking on the street on the opposite side of campus as my dorm. She likes that because she likes the long walk to my dorm, which gives her the chance to be at college, even if she isn't in college. Maybe one day she'll finally go, when she realizes how much life is still ahead of her, even after she's done raising Dusty's boys. This time, though, it's not a holiday, so the boys have school and soccer, and Dusty has work, and there was just no way she could make the trip. Charlie! She screams my name when she sees me enter the station from the back where the bus is let off the passengers. She screams it loud and proud because everyone in Sawyer has had to hear about me going to MIT a million times, and I think she imagines that the entire world can now see inside our snow globe as I re-enter its glass dome. She gives me a giant hug and takes my duffel bag. Then she starts talking and doesn't stop until we get all the way home and she has to make dinner. She talks about things I already know, as though she hasn't told me the exact same things on the phone every Sunday when I call her, or when she texts me every morning to wish me a great day. I've come back for Keller and Levi's wedding, so she starts there, about how normally she wouldn't be happy about such a young girl getting married, but in this case, it's nothing short of a blessing, because after they put Dot in the private nursing home, Keller was able to move in with Levi and save money on rent. And since she was now a co-owner of the Triple S, she only worked one job and was sort of a business owner, which, my mom says, is pretty darn good for a girl like Keller. Levi still works at the gas station, and she rolls her eyes when she tells me this. But at least he's going to marry her, so when they have their babies, which are sure to come any time now, Levi will have some legal obligations to take care of his family. Now she gets to Ian, and she treads lightly as we get into her car. She's nowhere near as pretty as you, or as smart. She shakes her head. Such a shame about that boy. But you don't need to worry about any of that yet. You just keep your head down and study, and who knows where life will take you. I smile and nod, but my stomach turns inside out when she says his name, Ian, and again when she talks about my future. I suppose Ian and I have stayed friends. I see him when I come home for vacations. We go out with Keller and Levi and other people who are new to me but old to them as they live their lives here and I live mine there. As for my dreams, well, I'm not sure what they are yet exactly. That's the thing about having a big dream like going to college. Once it comes true, you have to find a new one. I don't know why that is. I can't find an explanation, even though I study all kinds of things now. Not just math, but philosophy and history and feminist theory, which has shed so much light on my mother, I can almost see her squinting her eyes as it glares down upon her. Still, I am restless. I work on the side and in the summers to make ends meet. I study hard because MIT is a really hard school, but it's not enough. The restlessness inside isn't placated by keeping busy. It's a different kind of stirring than what my mother used to warn me about. But it's stirring nonetheless. Dusty is polite when I walk in the door. The boys come and give me a hug only after they're prompted, but I don't take it personally. They're boys, and they're getting older. I'm a girl, and that's not a good thing. Not yet. We have dinner, and my mother keeps talking and asking me questions, and I get through the night the same way I used to, with mild discomfort. It's easier now, because I know I'm here by choice, and that it will be over soon or whenever I want. Power over my life is something I have come to appreciate. There's no bachelorette party or rehearsal dinner or anything like that. Just a wedding at the church in town and a small reception in the gathering room down in the basement where they also hold the funerals. It's depressing, if I'm being honest. Keller looks beautiful, of course. Her half-brother gives her away, though I can see her cringe as she holds his arm. Dot sits in the front pew with a nurse and her half-brother's family, a wife and kids. And then, of course, there's Ian, and the woman my mother says is less than me in every way. But I don't bother to compare me to her, or her to me, or whatever it is my mother does when she sees them together. Because she's his fiancé, and they're going to be married in a year and raise a family in Sawyer, just as I predicted. Only my prediction didn't include him solving his father's murder. This is what I find myself wondering as I see them in the pew across the aisle as he turns and waves at me and mouths something about catching up after. I wonder why he didn't leave then. If it was because of his mother, or because he became a local hero after killing Ward Harlow and solving his father's cold case. Maybe that was enough for him. Whatever it is, I feel my heart break when I see him smile. I did love him. I know that now. And the heartache has to have something to do with the fact that he is going to spend his life with someone else. But there's something else, too. I see it on his face, the weathering from his torment. It's the same torment his father carried from the moment he froze on that trail and watched his friend die to the day his other friend turned him into roadkill on the outskirts of town. Ian spent his youth trying to avenge his father's death, and in the end, that vengeance will be his undoing. Vengeance for which he will never be punished because it would devastate his mother. Vengeance that goes against everything he stands for. I don't know how or when, if it will be slow and invisible to the naked eye, or if it will end in a blaze of horror and anguish. Whatever it will be, it's already breaking my heart. The ceremony is short and sweet and ends in a kiss. It's not as passionate as I remember, but time does that to kisses. It wears them down into something perfunctory and symbolic, but I don't pass judgment. It's this way for everyone. They are still beautiful together. A happy reunion follows. Nora, Janice, even Helen. I try to see them when I make it home for the holidays, but sometimes I don't. Sometimes it's too hard to go to the Triple S, even though they are now part owners, and I swear it's made each of them stand an inch taller. It's hard to go there and be reminded of Coop's murder and who killed him and what I did to cover it up and how all of us were so close to danger. But here, now, I give each of them a giant hug, even though I've had far too many people touching me today and there's more to come. I make myself soak it in. The feel of Janice's body and the smell of Nora's perfume, because these are the things that still make me feel the freedom that is now mine. It's good to be reminded of the time before your last dream came true. It feels important to remember. It's not long after that Keller grabs my hand and leads me out the back door. They've cut the cake and had a dance, and she's done with all of it. I talk to Keller more than I talk to my mom. We text every day. Little things about customers at the Triple S and updates on my new friends and a boy in my dorm I might like. Keller says that if we don't tell each other the little things, then eventually we'll never be able to catch up. So when she sends me a message that says, "Steak and cheese guy," with a round red face emoji, I know the shithead from the insurance company down the road was in the store ordering his usual sandwich and being, well, shitty. Those are things that keep our friendship alive. That's what Keller says, and I believe her, because here we are, getting into her car before her wedding is even over. We park under the hand of God. She hands me a beer from a cooler in the back seat, and she is every bit as innocent and pure and perfect as she's ever been. We sit on the hood and stare at the stars and listen to the cars roll by on the highway. Her dress spills over, white chiffon brushing the ground. I feel a quick shudder as my shoulders dance. There are so many good memories here. "Are you happy?" I ask her. She shrugs and drinks her beer, but her smile is wide and her eyes light up. And I imagine she's thinking about her wedding night and maybe all the nights that she gets to lie next to Levi and feel whatever kind of love she still has for him. I pray that her love grows into the Janice and Shane love and not the Nora and her dead husband love or the Eileen and Dusty love. But I can't predict the future, no matter how hard I keep trying. And I do. I keep trying. Even after everything that happened over those 5 days in our shitty little town, which seemed epic at the time, a tale about a battle between forces no less powerful than good and evil, a story about murder and money and sex and carnage worthy of headline news, the Pulitzer Prize, the Academy Awards, or maybe just a true crime podcast. But then I remember, This is just a story about one American girl, and nobody will ever notice. Still, every time I return, it seems that this piece of the world should have changed somehow, that this snow globe should have shattered, and yet it all feels the same, and it pulls at my ankles just like my mom said it would. Not love for a boy, but love nonetheless. Love for these people, for the past versions of me that they will always hold, for the smell of lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions, in the hand of God, and the stirring I once felt beneath it. It pulls me back, but I pull away, making a new rule as I return to my new life the next day. Rule number 37. There are no rules when it comes to love.
Hi, this is author Wendy Walker. I hope you enjoyed American Girl. Writing it was pure joy. Thank you to Audible Originals for creating this unique platform for telling stories, to Lara Blackman for her insightful editing and enthusiasm, to Dr. Katie Ort and Nicole D'Angelo for their professional and experiential guidance in crafting Charlie's character, to Wendy Sherman for putting this deal together, and to the late Tom Petty for writing a song that has lived in my bones for over 40 years.
This has been an Audible Original, produced by Audible Originals, written by Wendy Walker, performed by Paige Lael, with Carson Beck, Alexander Sendis, Hilary Huber, Josh Hurley, Carly Robbins, and Molly Secour. Executive Producers, Lara Blackman and Chelsea Pita. Producers, Mike Charzik and Chelsea Pita. Directed by Chelsea Pita. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Dave Hart. Sound design by Dave Hart. Acquisition and development, Catherine Stewart. Sensitivity reader, Nicole D'Angelo. Vice President of Audible Studios, Mike Charzik. Editor-in-Chief, Audible Original Publishing, David Blum. Copyright 2021 by Wendy Walker. Sound recording copyright 2021 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.